I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you'd like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. You can also reach us via Facebook at www.facebook.com/Prison Voices Project. Good morning. Today is Thursday, April 28th, 2016, and you are listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. I am your host, Karanja Keita Carroll. This morning's show features a public lecture by Dr. Ashley Nellis, Senior Research Analyst for the Sentencing Project. Her talk is on life sentences in America. This was a public lecture given on February 15th, 2016 at the Center for Ethics and Public Policy.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for coming. I hope this will be an engaging conversation on a topic that is very, very near and dear to me. I'll tell you a little bit about the Sentencing Project. Where I work. We are in Washington, D.C. We've been around since 1986, and we are a research-based advocacy organization. And we advocate principally for rational crime policy that is based on evidence and research and that emphasizes fairness and justice. My areas of expertise at the Sentencing Project are in two subjects. One, juvenile justice. I recently wrote a book, like was just mentioned, on a review of sort of the history of the juvenile justice system, followed by recommendations for reforming it and hastening reform along, in particular addressing the racial disparities in the juvenile justice system, which have remained unchanged over many years. And my other area of interest is people serving life sentences. The United States is alone in the expansive use of life sentences for violent and nonviolent offenders. And we advocate for a rethinking of many of our policies which have caused the expansion of life sentences. And so I want to talk tonight about life sentences, life with and life without parole, and I'll get into more of what that means. But first, for those who aren't aware, the United States is the world's leader in incarcerating people. This is our incarceration experience, starting in 1925 and going up to 2014, which is the most current year for which we have data. You can see that starting in the 1970s, the mid-1970s, we began our experiment, our so-called experiment with mass incarceration. And that moved its way into the war on drugs, which started in earnest in the 1980s and ended around the late 1990s. But we've continued to incarcerate at a steady pace all these years until just the last 2 years, we've started to see a slight receding. We now have 1.5 million people in prisons and jails, state and federal prisons, rather. Jails is another 700,000 or so. So we have 2.2 million people incarcerated in the United States. So if that isn't frightening enough, we also stand far and away the world's leader in incarcerating people. This is us compared to a dozen or so other countries, and this is the imprisonment rate per 100,000. The United States is about 5% of the world's population and about 24% of the people around the world who are in prison. So we have, we've slowly, like this chart shows, we've slowly, achieved this position. It didn't happen overnight. But it's also true that we were not always as punitive as we are today. The original criminal justice system was meant to reform individuals. That's why institutions were called reformatories. But because of a lot of reasons, we have sort of done away with that. And that is why we end up with a lifer population that has quadrupled since 1984. Just to put this in context, because I know that I'm in Minnesota, Minnesota has carried with the national trend. In fact, it actually hasn't receded at all in its prison population. In the last year, 2013 to 2014, it increased its prison population by 3.5%. And if you include the year before, it's a 6.5% rise. So hopefully there will be some change in that. Of course, usually when people see things like this, they say, oh, but what's going on with crime? So it's a good question. In Minnesota, you have actually experienced a decline in crime, both property crime and violent crime, since 1980. I can give you the numbers here. For violent crimes, the rate of violent crime per 100,000 has declined by 18% since 2000. And property crimes have declined by 28% since 2000. And that's not really to call Minnesota out. It's just to say this is what most of the states are doing. Despite rises and falls in crime, the prisons continue to fill. and there are many other reasons to say that that the crime rate does not have much to do with our prison overcrowding problem. So like I say, tonight I want to talk about life sentences. So there's a lot of sort of discussion right now. The Koch brothers, other people are very interested on reforming criminal justice, and they all have good reasons. There's a lot of cost associated with imprisoning 2.2 million people. We are a country that says we believe in second chances. It's hard to buy that when you are incarcerating 2.2 million people. but at the deep end of the system are the lifers, people who are serving life with and life without. So there's a distinction between the two, just to go over sort of the basics. A life sentence, typically, and here in Minnesota, is a sentence that you have to serve a certain part of it before you even up for parole. I believe here in Minnesota it's 30 years. That's pretty standard, 20 to 30 years. This is the overall lifer population in the United States. We have 160,000 or so people around the country serving life sentences. That includes people serving life without the possibility of parole. And we have 49,000 people serving life without the possibility of parole. So people serving life without have no opportunity of parole. This is news to some people that really does mean they're not ever going to get parole. They're not going to get a chance at parole. They are going to die in prison. So we have 50,000 of those, and we've had a 22% incline in our life without parole population just since 2008. I should say, before I go any farther, to give myself credit here, that I collect the data for lifers. As far as I know, we are the only entity that has a focus on life sentence population. I started doing this in 2008 and relied on data that had previously been collected for 2003, and I'm currently collecting data for 2016. Unfortunately, I haven't gotten Minnesota's yet, but it's due next Friday. For what I do every 4 years or so is I call each Department of Corrections and I ask them for the number of people they have serving life, the number of life without, the race, white, black, and other, the ethnicity, Hispanic or non-Hispanic, the gender, and also the crime of conviction. So I have all of this information for every single state for a number of years, and then going back to 1980 for some states. So this is this data I know very well, just wanted to share that. So this is sort of a national profile. These are the 2012 numbers. I break it down by adults and juveniles. Juveniles are people who were under the age of 18 at the time of their crime. There are about 2,500 juveniles serving life without the possibility of parole around the country. We are the only nation in the world that sentences children to life without parole. We also have about 9,000 juveniles serving life with the possibility of parole. And then the adults are the remainder. About 3.5% of lifers are women. And this has remained about, it's always been about 3.5% women. So this is Minnesota. Minnesota has had a steady incline of life with parole and life without parole since 2000. That's the date as far back as I've been given for Minnesota. It's very similar to many other states. Despite drops in crime and violent crime, property crime, in many states, I don't know if this is the case with Minnesota, in many states, the rise is largely composed of people who have been convicted of sex offenses. So these are not necessarily serial rapists, but people who have been convicted of some range of sex offenses. And there is a mandatory life. Here in Minnesota, there is mandatory life. That is, if you're convicted of first-degree murder, then there's no mitigating factors. It's if you're convicted of it, you get life without parole, and that's the end of the story. So I just wanted to put those up there. This presentation is not going to be a bunch of slides, but I just wanted to sort of start it out to give people a sense of where we are, the degree to which we've really built up our lifer population within an already bloated prison population. Let's see here. I don't know what's next. Oh, okay. So a little bit more information about the people serving life around the country. Most are people of color. Over half two out of three are non-white. In Maryland has the worst racial disparity. They have 3/4 of the people serving life sentences there are African American. Other states that are notable are Georgia and Louisiana, Mississippi and South Carolina, all southern states, and then Maryland is leading. And then 16% of them are Latinos, mostly in states that have a lot of Latinos. Most people are serving life sentences for homicide. For life without parole, it's about 85%. For life with parole, it's about 67% or so. But you can see there that you can't see there right now, but there's about 10,000 people there serving life sentences that have not been convicted of a violent crime at all. So it's kind of helpful to think about life sentences in two different ways. One is, if you look at lifers across the country, where are most of them? Most of them are in California. In fact, 25% of them are in California. Florida has the next largest proportion, and then New York, and then Texas. And then looking within a state, what are states that have the greatest number of lifers within their state? Again, California is pretty much always going to take the lead because California has a very large prison population, and also within it has a very large lifer population. Next is Nevada, Massachusetts, New York, and Washington. I believe Minnesota, just for your reference, has about 6.5% of its prison population is composed of lifers. So we'll take a break a little bit from slides there, and I just want to talk a little bit sort of set the stage for what I hope could be a discussion on this topic. So my biggest area of concern is lifers and the role of extreme sentencing, and I think that we got here not through crime, but through policy. And there's a number of policies that have contributed to the expansion of life sentences in the United States. And these are policies that are unique to the United States by and large. The first of which is the war on drugs. So the war on drugs, which spans the 80s to the 90s, dealt a lot with drug offenders, but in particular in the federal system. The federal system today, more than half of people in federal prison are there for a drug offense. More than half. And that is largely because of the war on drugs, and that's just really not being disputed. Whether that's a successful campaign is another matter, but the fact that more than half of the people in federal prison are there for a drug offense, and many of those people are serving a life sentence, a mandatory life sentence with no opportunity for parole, is probably a surprise to a lot of people here. We think the federal system is reserved for the Unabomber and things like that. It's not. Most of the people there, the majority of the people there, are there for a nonviolent, their particular crime there is a nonviolent crime. They usually had crimes in their past, but they're there for a drug crime for half of them. So there's the war on drugs. Many states and the federal system eliminated their parole board altogether in the 1980s. 1986 is when the federal system decided to just get rid of the parole system altogether. So in states Illinois, Louisiana, I believe Arkansas, Iowa, there's about seven other states in addition to the federal system. In the 80s and 90s, they decided to just get rid of parole altogether. So they have some lifers there, a dwindling population of lifers. But now, since they've gotten rid of that, anyone who gets a life sentence will be there for the rest of their life. There is no more parole system. And so that has significantly expanded the life population. There's also been an expansion of what's known as three strikes. You guys are probably all heard of that. They've migrated that over to the school system too, so maybe you heard about it there. So three strikes, habitual offender laws are laws where after a third felony, typically, you have a life sentence, either a life with or life without parole. In states like Georgia, for instance, you only have two strikes, and then you're there for life. And California is sort of the most notorious because the third strike, and this is what created such a large lifer population there, the third strike did not have to be a serious felony. In most states, it does have to be a felony. What has caused the increase of the juvenile serving life is the idea of waving juveniles into the adult system. This was an idea that became popular in the 1990s. there was a legitimate rise in juvenile crime in the 1990s. And one of the solutions that was most popular was to just decide that the juvenile system was not enough and that there was this notion of adult crime, adult time. And so the movement of kids into the adult system, without really giving a lot of thought to that exposing them to a life sentence, was made. And so a lot of lifers, I don't have a chart here, but it's similar to all the other charts, show a huge increase in life sentences for juveniles that occurred in the 1990s. Also, mandatory minimums. So mandatory minimums are another one of our policies here in America that we thought was a good idea in the 1990s. The idea that we're going to remove the discretion from the judge and we're going to look only at the crime and only at the at these factors and then calculate it, you know, the number of, the whether it was violent or not, what number of your, how many priors you had, all of these things that weighed in, and then mandatory sentence as a result. That also increased our sentencing to life. And then finally, you know, there has been a move to eliminate the death penalty. And let me be clear, I'm very opposed to the death penalty. But the accelerated pace at which we are eliminating the death penalty is making life without parole a little bit more favorable. And there is some evidence of this. In Texas in particular, I mean, not that they've gotten rid of the death penalty, but there's some evidence that life without parole is starting to rise as the state is using the death penalty a little bit less. And there are other states as well. New Mexico will be a great state to test. They recently got rid of their death penalty, and other states as well. So I think, I don't even know what we're at now in terms of states that have gotten rid of the death penalty, maybe nine. In the last several years. And, you know, it's on pace to go away altogether, if you ask some people. And this will make it, you know, both, this will make it very much a bargaining chip in the courtroom to have life without parole on the table. And there's some evidence, anecdotal mostly, that suggests that, you know, using life without parole as a humane alternative to the death penalty has led to an increase in life without parole, where we have seen a decrease in the death penalty.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC, and we have just finished listening to the first half of Dr. Ashley Nellis' lecture on life sentences in America. Let's take a short pause and listen to a Prison Voices Project favorite, Asha's track entitled Jailer.
So you treat me like a modern slave, Mr. Jailer.
I've got it.
Our uniforms, you are uniforms too.
Mr. Jailer, you suppress all my strife.
Mr. Jailer. I'm talking to you, Jailer. Stop calling me a prisoner. Let me hear you if you thought they'd be the first to cast a stone. Mr. Jailer. Mr. Jailer.
No. What we need is simple chords.
A,
you know?
Marketplace, don't throw stones. Even if you do, you just might want of your own. Life is not about your policies all the time, so you better rearrange your philosophies. I'll be good to your fellow man, Jailer. Stop calling me a prisoner. Let hear you if you fancy be the first that cast the stone. Mr. Jailer, oh, I'm talking to you, Jailer. Stop calling me a prisoner. Let hear you is without saying be the first that cast the stone. Mr. Jailer, Mr. Jailer, I am a baby say, I wanna be president.
And that was Asha singing a very beautiful acoustic rendition of her song, Jailer. We shall now return back to Ashley Nellis's lecture on life sentences in America, given at the Center for Ethics and Public Policy on February 15th, 2016.
So that's about all I have in terms of sort of how we got there. I'd like to spend the rest of my time talking about what I think, are sort of some of our ways out of it for those of us who would like to see a significant scaling back of life sentences in the United States. The first solution would be to rethink the carceral state generally. So in the U.S., we have really just use this one tool in our toolbox for public safety. We use incarceration. We put people in prison for all kinds of crimes. We don't reserve it for the worst of the worst. We use it for deterrence. We use it to teach a lesson. We use it for mental health. We use it for lots of things. And in other countries, prison is considered to be the very last resort. In the United States, there are 3 to 5% of a state's budget any given year is spent on its corrections, on its prisons. That's not even getting close to the rest of the criminal justice system. So the first idea would be to consider alternatives to prison for many people. So the most appealing population for this would be drug offenders. There's a growing consensus, I think, that the American public thinks that prison might not be the best place for people who have a drug addiction. Most of the people who are in state prisons, maybe not so much in the federal system, but most people in the state prisons who are there for a drug crime are there because they had a drug problem. So these are not people who are dealing mass quantities of drugs. These are people who had an addiction and who may have engaged in other crimes, property crimes, maybe even robberies, to support that addiction. And so if we start to view the drug problem in our country, and I think we're starting to do this with heroin. Unfortunately, we didn't even think to do it with crack. But with the heroin epidemic, we're starting to think about maybe not using the criminal justice system to treat drug addiction. Then that opens the space to consider other crimes, worse crimes, serious crimes. We also need to restore a sense of proportion. So proportionality is a huge part of the criminal justice system. Whenever you read a Supreme Court ruling about, cruel and unusual, the Eighth Amendment, and whether it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment, it's always about proportionality. We rest our whole criminal justice system on, in theory anyway, on whether the system whether a particular punishment is proportionate to the crime. And the court has gone back and forth on that, many times. But the fact that we have the death penalty, for one thing, but my talk is not about the death penalty, but the fact that we have life sentences and that we use them so generously in our country, in my view and in many others, it applies this upward pressure on our whole system. Because we have so many people serving life, and that because we've gotten so sort of indifferent to that in this country, that we have 160,000 people that we think don't deserve to be out on the streets, or maybe never deserve to be out on the streets, that we're okay with that now. It applies this upward pressure on all the other sentences. So if you look at other countries, and most other countries, I'm not just sort of cherry picking, most other countries, the very, very maximum sentence, even for a mass killer, would be 21 to 25 years. And then they either have to get out or they would be confined civilly. So that's so that could be someone like the guy in Norway whose name is escaping me right now. So he killed 77 people or something like this. This was a terrible crime. He got 21 years. He's going to serve the full 21 years. He's probably going to still be pretty crazy at the end of the 21 years, at which time they'll give him a review and they will sentence him to civil commitment. So that means the criminal justice system can't keep you anymore, but the community decided that they don't want you out either. And so there are other countries that do this. This is not ideal for the 160,000, but it's a mechanism that other countries use where there's this second look. This is something that we could do here in the United States. We have civil commitments here, but we don't use them very much. So for here, when you think about other countries, like I was saying, the other countries have a maximum of 20 to 25 years, 21 to 25 years. For us, a 25-year sentence for a drug offense is standard. I mean, people are used to that. Most people think 25 years. And I think that's partly because so many people have gotten 25 years and because there's this misnomer, there's this misinformation out there that 25 years means something other than 25 years, that it might mean 3 years or 8 years. When in large part, most criminal justice systems have done away with so-called good time. There is no such thing as good time anymore. There is something called diminution credits, and those sometimes apply, but it's not like in decades past, and it's certainly not like on Law and Order and the rest of the TV shows where they say, oh, don't worry, you'll be out in 10 years. It's not like that in the criminal justice system. So just to recap, my second point is that we really need to reshape our proportion, our proportionality view on criminal justice and on punishments in particular. We also need to reshape our conversation about what acceptable reform is and what achievable reform is and what sort of effective reform would be when we're talking about criminal justice reform. So I think I talked a little bit at the beginning about there are a lot of people, unlikely allies, who are starting to take up criminal justice. You know, we're hearing people like Newt Gingrich and Van Jones created this Cut 50 organization, trying to cut the prison population by 50% by, I don't know, some year. And they've since decided that they actually can't do that. But they're still very interested in criminal justice reform. The Koch brothers have invested lots of money in criminal justice reform, in passing a very, what would be a very important federal sentencing bill that's currently stuck in the Senate, but has made it pretty far. And if you consider Congress right now, which is really stalled on so many issues, there's a lot of bipartisan support right now in the Congress and in the state Congresses as well for reforming criminal justice, whether it's for cost reasons or for public safety reasons or because they're under court order to do so. There's a lot of room for reform ideas right now. But when we don't include the LIFER population, I think we're selling ourselves short. So a lot of the ideas out there are to reform our drug laws, and our drug laws are pretty bad. And so, you know, that's not a bad idea. But even if we did tomorrow, if we let out all of the drug offenders from prison tomorrow, we would still have the world's leading prison population by far. We would still have a problem of mass incarceration. So we would have a rate of incarceration that's higher than any other country in the world if we let out all the drug offenders tomorrow. So we cannot simply stop at drug offenders if we want to have an impact on mass incarceration. We're going to have to deal with the serious offenders and the violent offenders. Not the currently violent offenders, the people who were violent 20, 30, sometimes 40 years ago, and they've been sitting in prison since then, not having done anything to harm anybody for decades. Those are the kinds of people that we're advocating for and that we know empirically have a very small chance of affecting public safety in a negative way. The proposals that are offered today are really just too modest. I wanted to just go back and, you know, I've been talking about how there's this federal sentencing reform that's going on and there's these unlikely allies. There's a lot of also other signs in the just in the general public that criminal justice and mass incarceration are on people's minds. It's been in the debates, for one thing. But it's also, you know, there's a very famous book, I guess it's famous now, called The New Jim Crow. How many people have heard of this book, The New Jim Crow? At least some of you. So this is about... this is about mass incarceration and whether the elimination of Jim Crow South was simply replaced by the structure, the carceral state. Another book, which probably would generate even fewer hands, is called Just Mercy. It just came out. It's by Brian Stevenson. So brownie points for Maggie.
Yeah.
Not that I know all of your names. I actually only know her name. So... Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, who is just a brilliant person has been advocating on behalf of lifers and death penalty people for 30 years. That's being sold at Starbucks. So, you know, that the fact that that's going into mainstream America, that he's being interviewed by Oprah, and that his book, For Your Interest, Maggie, is going to be a movie, that's a huge thing. So, the fact that these kinds of concerns are making their way into the general public, that tells that tells those of us that work in this world that there's room. This is not something we could have said 5 years ago. Another way that we could get out of here would be to reform the conversations around sentencing and criminal justice reform to include lifers. To warm people up to the idea that even people who have committed serious crimes and have demonstrated reform and have demonstrated remorse and have clearly shown that they are not a harm to the world and to their communities are eligible at least for a parole review. These are just baby steps. This is not saying that lifers should get all the lifers should get out tomorrow. But we have 60,000 people in prison right now who are going to die in prison and who will never get a second look because of things that they did that were usually pretty, you know, that usually involved a homicide. But, you know, that may have had contextual things going on that would provide some explanation for it, although never an excuse. And they would be, oftentimes, they would be the first ones to tell you that. So we have this, you know, pointed exclusion of lifers from the debate because we are really sticking to the tough on crime rhetoric. In the United States, tough on crime is such a win for anybody, Republican or Democrat. The Democrats in the 90s imposed some of the worst crime policies that we've ever seen. So this really isn't partisan. And the narrative that we need to continue to be tough on crime is really what's standing in the way, in my view, of really taking on meaningful criminal justice reform. Because when we exclude the lifer population and the deep end population, we're not allowing for, you know, sort of a new perspective on our whole criminal justice system. We are a system that is sufficiently tough even if we don't give 160,000 life sentences. And finally, and this is perhaps the most radical idea, is that we need to incorporate a sense of forgiveness and a sense of mercy and a sense of redemption into our criminal justice system. These are parts of our criminal justice system that were with us at the beginning. We had a system that relied on reformation, that relied on reflection. This is the whole idea of solitary, which has obviously been used in the wrong direction since then. But the whole idea of solitary was originally designed so that people could reflect on their original crime and that they could have remorse for it. That was the idea of houses of correction. That's why they were called houses of correction. That's why they were called departments of correction, because we thought that we could actually correct people. We always believed that we could correct people. But we sort of did away with that idea. And and now we're finding ourselves with a solution that is not sustainable. You know, we cannot sustain a prison population of 2.2 million. So you might have heard, you probably didn't, but the Washington Post did this piece just recently about forgiveness. And it was talking about Proposition 47, which is something that passed in California in 2012, which basically repealed the state's three strikes law. I think I shared with you already that the state's three strikes law was the sort of the toughest in the nation because you didn't have to have a serious crime for your third strike. So in Prop 47, they said that was wrong. And not only is it wrong going forward, but we're also going to make it retroactive. And so as a result, California has released 4,500 people who were serving life sentences since 2012. And So you might have heard that recidivism rates in prisons are pretty high. Usually 50% or so come back. For the lifers, the recidivism rate so far has been between 2 and 3%. And, there's a lot of reasons for that. But all of that is to say that lifers tend to be the lowest recidivists, usually because the crime that they did was a one-shot deal. That they weren't a chronic offender, and usually because they've been in there a while, they've grown up. So we know empirically that as people, just like all of us, as we get older, our perspective on life changes, we gain a longer-term vision for our life, we mature. Developmentally, we know that people who are under the age of 24 literally don't have a fully developed brain. That is why people in their early 20s and in their teens act a little risky, because they're literally acting without a fully developed prefrontal cortex. So when somebody gets into their 20s, and you see this all over the place, but also in certainly in criminal justice, by their mid-20s, they are much less likely to engage in crime. So we have to sort of let that set in. Why are we continuing to incarcerate people into their 80s and their 90s by the thousands when they are absolutely no public safety risk at all? And so obviously that is because we've switched our whole reason for incarcerating to one that's dominated by vengeance and retribution and incapacitation. And we've done away with these other pieces that are effective public safety tools, forgiveness, mercy, rehabilitation, and all of these things. So it bears repeating that some people will never be ready for release. Usually, Charles Manson, for instance, will probably never be ready for release. He's serving a life sentence. He actually has life with parole. That's why we hear from him every 7 years, and he is denied parole because he's still crazy. And there are some people who are going to be that way. But to put an entire, tens of thousands of people in prison and assume that they are all Charles Manson is just factually wrong. So the one place where we've started to see some movement on this idea of redemption and reform is in the juvenile arena. And I'll just talk a little bit about juveniles. I don't know where I am with the time. I'm okay? Oh, there I am. And so with juveniles, so we have 2,500 people serving juvenile life, life without the possibility of parole, and then an additional 7,000 serving life with the possibility of parole. So in 2010, the United States Supreme Court took up the first of three cases serving concerning juveniles. The first was called Graham v. Florida. And in this case, they ruled that juveniles cannot be given life without the possibility of parole for crimes that did not include a homicide. So that was about 200 of the 2,500 or so that were serving life without parole for things like robbery, kidnapping, multiple armed burglary, things like that, that did not include a homicide. In 2012, we went back to the court and asked for the court to review sentences of life for sentences for juveniles serving life without parole that had been given those sentences through a mandatory sentencing scheme. So I think I said at the beginning, some states have a system where if you commit first-degree murder or a certain kind of first-degree murder, it's an automatic life without parole sentence. So the vast majority of the juveniles who are in prison today, 2,000 of the 2,500, are there under a mandatory sentence. That means that the judge was not allowed to look at their age or any mitigating circumstances related to their age. So 70 or so of those people were under the age of 15 when they arrived at prison, and as young as 13 years old. So the advocates won Miller also, but the court was not terribly clear, at least not clear enough to some states, on whether that was retroactive. So the 2,500 people, they wanted to benefit from the Miller ruling, and so a plaintiff came back to the court last year under a ruling called Montgomery v. Louisiana. He'd been in prison for 40 years. He's in his late 60s. He's been there for decades. He asked the court whether he could benefit from the Miller ruling. And the court came back and said yes. All of the 2,000 juveniles will now benefit from that ruling. They will all get resentenced. That's a huge victory. The downside of that is that the ruling was very careful to say that it is because you are a juvenile that you get this second look. So it's going to take some work to extend that kind of mercy to adults. Currently, the court has been very clear that life without parole is not cruel or unusual. So let me just close by saying that, when somebody is killed, and most of these crimes include somebody who has been killed, it's very natural to respond by saying that, the victim is not getting a second chance. The victim is not getting an opportunity to heal and to grow, and yet you're advocating for the person who killed the victim to get this. But as a matter of public policy, I would say that we need to ask ourselves, do we want to be the kind of society that allows those who pose no real threat to public safety to languish and die in prisons for no other reason but for vengeance.
You have been listening to Ashley Nellis' public lecture on life sentences in America, here on the Prison Voices Project, WGXC 90.7 FM. We hope that you enjoyed this week's show, and we look forward to hearing your feedback. You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of the people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you're listening to the program and you have ideas for the program or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Please remember that we can also be found on Facebook at www.facebook.com/prisonvoicesproject.
Love!